Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Borderless Podcast. I'm your host, James Guzman, and today we're going to be talking about vacation rentals with a good friend of mine, Tim Hubbard. We spent a lot of time together when I was down in Medellin, and he's still there. So we do talk about Medellin. We talk about managing vacation rentals from another country remotely, and a lot of good information there. So I hope that you enjoy it. And if you are just listening to the podcast and you don't go to the blog or you're not on the email list, then you won't see that I've also put out some videos since the last podcast about vacation rentals, one about essential technology that you'll want to be using, and another that's comparing rental arbitrage, managing other people's properties, or owning your own property. Which of those three, I do the pros and cons, which of those three you want to use to get started or to grow your business. I did a video on that. It's on YouTube, so please do subscribe to me on YouTube. I put out different videos there. And remember, go to the blog, borderlessblog.com, and sign up for the mailing list. Also, if you would like, I can do a consultation for you. I'm on clarity.fm. So a lot of people do sign up for consultations for individual questions that they can have that they think I can help them with. So check it out. It's all at borderlessblog.com. All right. Well, here we go with the interview. Again, this is Tim Hubbard, a young guy who's been successful with rental real estate and is growing. And first met him at the Jason Hartman conference in La Jolla, which was awesome. And so I think there's a lot of good information here. So I hope you enjoy it. And here we go. Borderless. All right, everybody. Welcome, Tim. Thanks for talking to me today.
Yeah. Great to be here.
Cool. Yeah, I just thought that, you know, the listeners of the podcast really enjoy listening to your story. You know, you've definitely been, you know, you've achieved what a lot of people would like to do, you know, create location-independent income, real estate investments. And now would you say you live like full-time in Medellin?
Yeah. Yeah. Aside from going to conferences and visiting family occasionally in the States. Yeah. I would call this home.
Right. For right. Sure. And you do a lot of traveling. I mean, you're always going around.
Yeah. Yeah. I try probably used to travel more probably than I'm traveling now just because I like it down here so much, but yep. It's still a couple months or so a year, I'd say.
Right. Yeah, we spent some time in Medellin when I was there together hanging out and stuff, a lot of time. And it's really a cool place. I know you really enjoy it. And it's a place that a lot of people are interested in as far as that goes. Just a ton of, like, you know, what you would call, like, digital nomad types or, you know, that kind of thing. So you bought a house down there. You bought one house, right?
Yeah.
You haven't bought any more. But anyways, so maybe we could back up and talk about, you know, where you're from, how you started, and, you know, how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. I'm from California, Sacramento, northern part, and started investing in real estate about 10 years ago, but not full time. I was working as a salesperson for a software company, but as an independent contractor, so my schedule was flexible, could make my own hours. So I was doing real estate at the same time. And the real estate's just grown to a point now where I can, you know, basically live wherever I want. And I changed the way I was in real estate a few years ago, too, and started looking primarily for properties I could convert to short-term rentals.
Right.
And so that's mainly what I invest in now. And I have teams, one in Sacramento, one in Tennessee, that helps me with the rentals that I have. So...
Yeah, and so you have Midtown Stays is the name of your company. How long has that come about? I mean, how many units in all do you have now?
I have 27 active ones right mm-hmm. now. I should have four more up by the end of July. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's been about 4 years, maybe five, and it's been growing pretty quickly. I think I've already accommodated over like 10,000 guests. Mm-hmm. So it's grown pretty quickly.
Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, you started out kind of the regular path a lot of people do when they're doing real estate, right? With the Kiyosaki and that kind of thing. Would you say, how did you, like, in the beginning, how did you learn about real estate and what that can do for you?
Yeah, no, totally. I was going to college in Long Beach in Southern California. My buddy gave me Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad audiobook. Yeah. started listening to that, and it was like ever since then just kind of changed my mindset. Mm-hmm. So the first property I bought was a fourplex, and I lived in one of the units and the other three paid my rent. So I've literally, like, you know, I've followed that model for the last 10 years, and I've almost never really even paid rent since then.
Yeah.
You know, so it allowed me to, it's been great. It's allowed me to invest, you know, save and invest.
I think that's a way that a lot of people do it. And they, you know, they start out with sales, because sales is something that you can make a lot of money in the beginning. Was it like 100% 100% commission thing, or did you get a salary, or did you just, sounded like you really went out there and got it and sold a lot of the software subscriptions?
Yeah, it was like a door to door thing. They mm-hmm. we didn't get paid a salary, but they did have a renewal commission. So if I sold someone, I got like an upfront commission, and then the renewal part built a little bit. But right. So basically, you know, you didn't sell anything, you didn't make anything. But yeah. It was a good opportunity for sure. And I met tons of different personality types and learned to work with all kinds of people. And it was good.
Yeah.
It was
good. And so you basically, you know, you started out sales, started investing in real estate, and now you're moving on to like books and courses and things like that. I mean, it's like that. You're following like the game, the cash flow game, right?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
That's cool. That's cool. But I mean, you really, you've done it well. I mean, it's exactly what a lot of people want to do. So, once you started, you know, where you were living in one of them, you said, there was a few other units in your real estate. And now you've gotten to a point where, you know, you set up a team and all that. What about people that, you know, if they want to transition, how do they go about like recruiting a team? What do you start with your cleaners? That kind of thing. Like, you know, that's kind of the next yeah. level from just renting out a duplex to going and setting up a company.
Yeah, no, it's a gradual process, but I think the easiest way to do it is to work, you know, with your housekeeper and have your housekeeper help you. That she or he's going to be there anyways, so they're going to know your property well.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy to give them extra responsibilities, which you can pay them for, and they can almost become like your manager.
Yeah.
Which is essential, because you need to take yourself out of the equation so you can, you know, if you're cleaning your units or whatever, it's a lot harder to scale and things like that. But it's good to start there, because then you learn the whole business, basically. I mean, it's going to be that same thing, just on a broader, more scalable level.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do that. I mean, I've done the same. You use your, you know, your cleaner to then take over a lot of different aspects. I mean, they need to be getting supplies, you know. They need to be, you know, if you can get them to also answer guests and stuff like that, give them a checklist, you know, for inspections and what they're supposed to be doing at each thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just give them a little bit of extra responsibility like that. And then, you know, I would say also a maintenance person, right? That's really important, is to have a maintenance person that you can call and is very responsive. You know, were you able to find that? How'd you go about finding a maintenance person?
You know, in the beginning, it's definitely more difficult to find a maintenance person that's going to be real dedicated, especially if you only have like one unit, you know, because you may not have a maintenance issue for 2 months or something.
Right.
So, but I think it is easy to go in and say, okay, I need to have 3 phone numbers for a plumber. I need 3 phone numbers for an electrician. If you can find a handyman that can do all those things, then that's probably ideal, you know, but just always have a backup. So basically just go and make some phone calls and you get a list of contacts. Mm-hmm. That way, whenever an issue, you got multiple people to call, and someone will show up. You may have to pay them more, but when you're smaller, you know, that's fine. When you get bigger, you can hire someone that's more full time, you know, and they're going to be a lot more motivated to stay with you because you're keeping them busy.
Yeah, sure. I try to concentrate my work on one person. So even if it's not a full-time position, they're getting a lot of work from me. So like the gardening, and if I do have any like larger jobs that I, you know, like rehabbing a house or rehabbing part of the apartment or something like that, I'm going to give those jobs to them so they know that they're getting mm-hmm. a lot of business from me. And so they'll be a little bit more responsive, and then also have, you know, like backup people like that. So,
yeah.
So when you were doing, you know, so you moved over to Memphis from, you started out in Sacramento, right?
Yeah.
And so did you do market research, or how did you decide on Memphis?
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking to expand into another market for a while, just because the fundamentals and stuff in California in the market that I was in just weren't really making sense anymore. You know, there's a lot of places where you could get way better returns. So, you know, I've always kind of gone to conferences, you know, at least a couple of years after I started investing, I started going to conferences and listening to podcasts, and you hear about a lot of the same markets that pop up for cash flow. And so I went around, visited like four or five different cities and met with the property managers and viewed the markets, and just ended up finding the best opportunity in Memphis.
That's, you know, a lot of people, you know, they start out somewhere that they like or something like that. But, I mean, really, when you're just doing market research, it's all about the demand. And you're doing – but you started with long-term rentals, wasn't it? Or was it always short-term?
Yeah. And I still do long-term rentals where they make – you know, where they make more sense, I guess.
Right. And so what would you say are like good metrics when you're looking at the viability of, you know, long-term or short-term rentals? If you're looking to get into a city, what tools do you use, or what metrics do you use?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people use like a rent-to-value ratio as a way to compare one market to the other. So like how much rent you're going to get back per dollars invested.
Right.
So if it was a $100,000 house, a lot of people like to say, oh, I'd at least like to make 1% rent to value ratio. So $1,000 a month. So that's a good way to compare markets. You know, you can look at properties and just go off the numbers. But I think there's a lot of other things to consider, too. You know, like, is the population growing? Is employment growing? Is it a diverse, you know, are there diverse industries there? So if, you know, a company goes out of business, it's not going to really hurt the whole city. And then for short-term rentals, they're different too, right? Because you want to be in an area where people want to go, or where people need to go. And so my company, Midtown Stays, I've focused on Midtown areas, you know, basically between downtown and the suburbs, because I find that it's attractive to a lot of business people, but then also tourists. So I think if you can combine those into, you know, the fundamentals, like, you know, the strong employment and population growth, then you can really get some much better returns.
What about restrictions on short-term rentals? Have you had any problems with that? I know that in the States, a lot of places are passing different laws and things like that to restrict that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I started looking outside of Sacramento, is because they passed regulations. I've been doing short-term rentals for a couple of years, and they came along and changed some of the rules and made it a lot more difficult. And so, absolutely, that's like, after finding a market that makes sense to invest in, just based off the fundamentals, like number two, if you're looking to invest in short-term rentals, you got to make sure it's either already approved, you can get a license, because if you're looking to invest in a property for a short-term rental and it's not approved, or you can't do it and they change the law, it could totally screw everything, right?
So, right.
I like to find properties that make sense even if the laws change. So if the law changes and I can't rent it out short term, I can put a long term rental tenant back in there and the property still cash flows and I'm still in a good spot. So I don't buy anything that doesn't follow that guideline. Then I'm always protected, really.
That's good. Yeah, I've heard a lot about, I should really look more into it, maybe do a video about all the specific regulations, but I have heard that in the States, and even in different countries, they're like really cracking down, I think, because people are going crazy with Airbnb and doing stuff that is kind of upsetting people.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of questions around it, you know, and so I know that there's a lot of different things going, and we'll see how that goes. I think Airbnb's going, has an IPO this year, so they're trying to flush out all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, it's within a city, you could have multiple different ordinances.
Right.
You know, so you could have one neighborhood that's allowing it while the other one's not. And And so, yeah, you definitely got to be on top of it. Like Medellin here in Colombia, for example, like it's really strict. Mm-hmm. It's really strict. You know, part of the reason most is because most people live in sort of condo associations. So you have a lot of owners next to, you know, they've lived there for 20 years or something. They don't want people coming in for a day every other day. So,
right. And are short-term rentals technically, are they allowed like by law, or they're just restricted by most of the homeowner associations?
Here in Medellin, they're mainly, so they're only allowed by law if you have an actual, like tourism permit, which is very hard to get, or the way that you could get approval is if you owned 50% or more of a whole building. So you had, you know, the majority vote. Yeah. Or the owners in the building allowed it. But other than that, no, it's like, I mean, it's like 90%+ of these properties, they wouldn't allow it for less than a 30-day period.
So are you thinking about doing anything there? Or are you just going there to live and keeping all your rentals or your investments in the States?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it, done a lot of research, and I think it has really good opportunity here to invest in, but not necessarily in short-term rentals because it's just so tricky, you know what I mean? And it's also a much slower – the market moves way slower here, so things are going to take longer, and then there's no financing. Right. So for me, like, I know 100% I make – a way better return investing in the States because I can get financing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I do think there is a lot of opportunity here. Just, I mean, the city's been appreciating year over year for, you know, close to 10 years, and it's in a valley. So, you know, there's only so much people can build, and the tourism's growing and people are moving in. So I think it has a lot going for it. I think on a dollar per dollar basis, though, it's just a lot easier and more lucrative in the States.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there might be an opportunity in Medellin, not necessarily for vacation rental, but for kind of the digital nomad community or the expat community. A lot of people come down there for 1, 2, 3 months, 6 months, and they can't, you know, it's kind of tough to get a place. So maybe like you could cater to that market somehow. But
yeah, I think. Yeah, definitely. You know, 30 most properties, if you're renting for 30 days or more, there's no restrictions. Mm-hmm. And you can still get pretty good monthly rates, you know, with the furnished place.
Yeah.
But it, again, it's like you go back and you compare other markets in the States where you could do it nightly and you can use financing. Yeah. You can get furniture easier. You can close on the properties easier.
Yeah.
Comparatively speaking, yeah, it's just there's a lot more opportunity, I think, in the States.
Yeah, that financing thing is really big. I mean, you know, there's hardly anywhere else in the world that you can get financing like the States, you know. And right. So that's a big, big plus. So let's talk about financing. When you first started with that first building that you had, did you use your own financing or how did you go about doing that?
Yeah, I bought that place as my primary residence. So that's like, you know, if you're just getting started in real estate, you're going to have the absolute best interest rates in terms as a first-time home buyer. Or not necessarily the first-time home buyer, but if you use an FHA loan. So I put down like 3.5%, you know, which was hardly anything. And that was all being paid for like the moment I moved in, you know. I actually renovated that place, so I didn't move into it like on day one, but after I renovated it and put new tenants in the other three units, I was living there for free. I was covering you know, all my payment and everything.
Right. So and then as you expanded, how are you're doing the financing for that?
So I've done a number of different ways now because I'm buying multifamily properties that you have to get commercial loans on too, and that's a totally different ball game. But for any of the single family or multifamily up to four units, you can still use conventional financing. It's normally like 20% down, pretty good rates. And if it's four units or less, you can get 30-year fixed loans, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
The commercial stuff, so 5 units or more, are usually much smaller loan terms. 5 years is pretty common. Mm-hmm. And then they either balloon in 5 years, so they're due, or you have to refinance, or you have to have the interest rate adjust. And the amortizations are normally shorter, like 20 years, 15 years. So your monthly payment will be a little higher. But at the same time, it's also a lot easier sometimes to work with local lenders that do commercial loans. You know, whereas like if you go out and get an FHA loan, you know, there's all these different regulations and things you have to meet. You go into a new market where you have a local lender and they know the area. I mean, they can get loans done really quickly sometimes too, and without, you know, too much delay, and you know, they don't have to jump through a bunch of hoops. So
right. Well, I remember like a year ago, you looked like you were, you know, you had a proposal. You were trying to get a bunch of private money together to do a deal too. So you've done that as well, right?
Yeah, I've done a couple like small joint ventures. So the last one, that one that I did last year, I brought two partners in. I manage everything, and you know, they're just kind of passive basically. But yeah, I've done that a couple times. It's worked out well for everyone.
Yeah, yeah, sweet man. That's, I mean, that, you know, you can do some big deals like that, just raising money. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
So as far as when you're doing short term, do you put it on all the different platforms? Is there one platform that they use specifically, or people, you know, do they have direct bookings through you? Do you like how do you go about getting the bookings?
I use mainly Airbnb and HomeAway and VRBO. Mm-hmm. I used to use booking.com. I don't use them anymore. And it's been a few years. I've heard they've kind of gotten better, but you know, each listing site has a different type of guest.
Yeah.
And so you just have to make sure that their expectations are being met. And the more listing sites you use, the more complicated it can get. Yeah. I do have my own website, which is usually just for return guests. I don't really market it except for repeat guests.
Yeah.
And it does okay. I think I maybe do almost like 10% of my bookings now just through there, which is great.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I like to put, you know, my business card or some sort of stationery that, you know, directs people to the website and say, hey, you know, you can save 10 to 15% if you go directly to the website. And, you know, I have like an e-guide or an actual printed guide for people so that, you know, try to direct people there and, you know, let people know. But I think that's really, you know, if you have a good number of units, trying to get people onto your own website is really a good idea. And then because, you know, people have had problems with different platforms, and also, you know, you never know, one of the platforms can go away. You know, it's not, people never think that that could happen, but it does happen. You know, businesses come and go. And so it's good to have like an email list of people that have stayed with you, and, returning guests and all that type of stuff, that then basically you have what they call booking site independence or something like that. But you basically have, you know, your own customers. So I think, you know, that's kind of the next level. People should think about setting up their own website and not being beholden to, like, a lot of people, they just stay on Airbnb, you know, and to me that's like really risky. Although that's where most of the market is still, you want to diversify a little bit.
And there's so many tools now to be on multiple sites without having all the complications. You know, you can have shared calendars and all those things, but
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the listing site independence is like the end goal, you know, because Airbnb could go away tomorrow, and if you still have people coming in, I mean, it's all about keeping your occupancy.
You know,
up.
It's never happened to me, but I've heard that sometimes they'll just shut people's account down and they won't tell them why.
So I actually, this just happened.
Really?
To me on, well, I didn't know that it had actually started several days ago, but I didn't know because I handle all my messages. Well, my team handles all of our messages through our property management software. So we don't log into Airbnb on a daily basis. You know, we don't really need to. And they had closed my Sacramento properties down due to security with my account online, and I hadn't logged in. So we had like 5 days where none of the Sacramento listings were even viewed. And most all of my bookings happened within about 10 days or 2 weeks. So it actually impacted my occupancy quite a bit for this week.
But what about your current renters? I mean, did you have any check-ins or something? Were you not able to access the account?
No, the messaging was still going. It was still synced to my property management software. So no one knew, you know. Things were still going through. It's just that the reservation stopped.
Wow.
And my housekeeper in Sacramento, you know, she relies on her income. That's what she does full time there. And she noticed, like, hey, why is the calendar looking a little slow next week? And then we found out that they had actually turned it off. But, didn't notify us, didn't call us.
Wow. And why?
It was, you know, I don't know. I log in from Columbia here all the time, and I think that maybe triggered something because the properties are in the States. So it was like my account security something. But I don't know. I had, you know, I'm on several chats and group things, and someone that I met in Israel actually last year at a conference for my property management software wrote in the chat, hey, is anyone having problems with Airbnb? And I wrote that, and he's like, oh, same thing happened to me.
Let everybody know you use Guesty, right? That's what it works well for you as a channel manager and a PMS system.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And they had a conference in Israel, right? How was that? Pretty good.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. You know, I've been using their software since the beginning almost.
Yeah.
I did explore a lot of other softwares, and I liked theirs for certain reasons.
Right.
But they were new when I started with them, and so they've really expanded, and it's really come a long way. And so it was nice to be there and, you know, meet with them and see what they have on the horizon too.
Cool, man. And so that's crazy about Airbnb, man. I mean,
yeah. And
so when you called them, were they responsive, or they said, I don't know, we got to get back to you, or what?
I didn't actually even call them. I just went on, and it was like, so it wouldn't let me on. Like, I, you know, it was like your account's blocked or something. And I'm like, oh, this isn't good. You know? And it let me log back on and answer security questions and do all that. So they must have increased their security or something on a company, and it affected some people. I don't know.
Yeah. Has that happened to you on any other of the platforms?
No. No. Okay. No, I don't think so.
All right.
First time. And that's in, you know, 5 years. First time anything like that's happened.
Well, hopefully that's the last time. I have on some of the groups, you know, like the Facebook groups for short-term rentals, I do see people, so, you know, not very often, but I have heard about people getting shut down without a reason why, you know, completely.
Yeah. And
That's pretty bad. So, you know, another reason why you want to try to transition and diversify a little bit. Maybe you want to let people know what other technologies you use. So you use Guesty, which is a channel manager and a PMS. Yep. Do you use any smart locks or any other type of technology?
Yeah, I use, I use whatever technology I can find that makes things more seamless, better for the guest, better for the company. So I use smart locks on all of our properties.
Which smart locks do you use?
I have several different brands just because I started quite a while ago and I experimented with new ones. Now I get the Lockstate brand, mm-hmm. mainly because they have a web platform where I can view the battery levels of the door locks. I can set unique codes per reservation. So, and I can automate that also. So a guest makes a reservation, they automatically get a unique code, and it expires when their reservation expires. Mm-hmm. So it really helps with security. And their platform allows for quite a few other brands now too. I just ordered one for a property in Sacramento this week that isn't a Lockstate brand, but it's going to work on their platform.
Nice.
I think that was a, not Slage, but
Masterlock, maybe. Or was it called?
No, it wasn't Masterlock. Quickset. It was a Quickset.
Okay, I don't know that one.
Yeah.
So you're looking at like $300 a lock or something like that, right? Or more?
That was close to 200.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. All right.
I just did the deadbolt. It was just a deadbolt. I replaced the deadbolt right. that's on the door, and then I put a passage handle down below. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll add, you know, locks that you can lock just from the inside, so there's never a key issue. And then I always have a lock box on every property, too, like just worst case scenario.
Okay.
So, yeah, definitely digital locks. I use pricing software to automate all my pricing. I use Price Labs.
Price Labs, yeah. I use Price Labs, too.
I used to use Beyond Pricing. I switched just because they're charging a percentage. Mm-hmm. Starting to add up quite a bit.
And yeah.
I found a big difference with Price Labs. And then I used to use another one also. Can't remember what it was, but they actually just stopped doing pricing. So I know there's a few out there.
Yeah, there's a number. I was using Wheelhouse for a while too. I liked Wheelhouse, but it didn't integrate right with my channel manager anymore, so I had to stop using it. But now I use Price Labs and it's fine. But I actually like Wheelhouse too. But Wheelhouse is a percentage as well. It's right. You know, it's 1%, so it's not horrible. But
yeah. Anyways,
yeah. That's great. And any other things you use? E-guides, or I think you started using You're Welcome, right? But then you stopped.
Yeah. I ordered one and it sat in an apartment for a year, I think, and the subscription came around and it's my fault. I just never set it up. I think it has some great features.
Oh, okay.
But it was also like I was already automating my guidebooks. So I use Coral.life, which is a real simple service and it's actually free.
Oh, wow.
And I send those out automatically via email and text message. And so that was a big part of the You're Welcome, and I already had that set up, and so I don't use You're Welcome anymore. But I did order a one of those noise aware devices recently. I had one unit that for some reason or other was more prone to parties, so use that. The channel manager, I use Rentals United, which links into my property management software.
Right. What about cameras?
You know, I don't use any cameras right now. Okay. And I did change some of my policies and things, so they're a little more strict. They have to require more information and stuff.
Yeah.
And things have been pretty good. I haven't really had too many issues. And
yeah.
And, I do. Most of my units are smaller, so they're not set up for like big parties anyways, you know, so they attract more of a business person.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And yeah, so that's probably all the technology you use, right? Nothing. Yeah, it's automated.
Yeah, there's some other apps and things I'm exploring. Yeah. But for the main part, yeah, those are kind of.
Do you find it necessary to have an office, or is all this done online, like with your whole team?
Yeah, it's all online.
Sweet.
We have some WhatsApp groups. You know, with different people in them that we can communicate on different things. And yeah, it's all online.
Okay. What about managing other people's units? Have you done that, or they're all your own?
They're all my own. And yeah, I've been asked that a lot.
Yeah.
And it is something I'm going to do. I already have the team set up. I already have offices in place. I've done thousands of guests. So I know the little things to look out for. So it'll be sort of like, more of like a cherry picking thing. I probably would want to do smaller multifamily buildings like I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think probably maybe towards the end of the year, I will have that set up.
Cool. All right. Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, I think people get the idea of how you got to be able to do that. And then you were able to, basically have location independent income, and you've gone to a lot of different places, and then you chose Medellin. What were some of the were you like trying out different places to see where you like to go, and what were some other places that you considered?
I don't know, I kind of like the Latin culture a lot, you know. And I came down to Medellin like 4 or 5 years ago just on vacation. I had a buddy living down here and that I went to college with, and he's lived abroad for, 8 plus years now. And so it was almost like I totally scored. I mean, not only is he a great friend, but he also introduced me to all these amazing places. So we traveled together in a lot of spots in Asia and Buenos Aires and, you know, lots of, and I really like a lot of them, Brazil. But for me, Medellin, the weather's great.
Yeah.
Cost of living's fantastic. The people are amazing. They're just like, they're so nice here, you know, and it's every day. And that just the pace of living is a lot. I like it a lot more than how it was where I was living in the States.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And you know, something I found really cool about Medellin that surprised me is that they have like part of their culture is like they're really into like health and fitness and hiking. Where we were staying before, every Sunday, you know, they had the, what is that, ciclovia.
Yeah.
Right there in front, and everybody's riding their bikes out there with their dogs, and we used to go and ride our bike. At one time, what was it, like 12 miles we went and rode our bike?
Yeah.
And you can go ride a bike for like $2.
Yeah. Yeah, and they give you free water.
And you go hiking up the big, to the Tres Cruces, and then they got an open air gym at the top, and really, really cool. Every weekend, they also, I don't know if you've done this, but every weekend, and also with the, I guess the same organization that does the Ciclovia, they have like a hiking thing every weekend that you can go to, and they have a different place that they go. And so a lot of cool stuff like that, and you know, really into like the, you know, the gym and stuff like that.
Totally, yeah. It's very active, you know.
Right.
People are, and yeah, Sundays are great. Everything's, you know, and people actually like take Sundays off, and they take holidays off, you know, and they take vacations, which is really nice. It seemed like, you know, and I was living in the States, holidays just became another work day. I don't know, you know, right, aside from the big ones like Christmas and
we're just we're just finishing up Memorial Day, so I'm sure a lot of people had a good weekend last weekend.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hopefully, yeah. That's right.
I was thinking about that here. I was like, man, it'd be kind of nice to be in the States right now. You know, Memorial Day weekend's usually pretty fun. Go out there on a boat.
That's right. That is a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cool places around there too. You know, little villages and towns and things like that you can take a day trip.
Totally. Yeah, tons of pueblos, and I'm actually getting my driver's license right now. So
how hard is that?
It's a lot harder than it used to be. They're actually using the same sort of system that they use in the States now to monitor tickets and licenses and all those types of things. So it's a lot more difficult than it was, but it's not too bad. And so I got to get a little Jeep or something, just basically to explore around the city, because there are so many cool spots. And I think there's a lot of opportunity with some of the land surrounding Medellin also, you know, in terms of investments. Mm. But yeah, it's just so nice. You know, the hills are green, the weather's great, and the beautiful views. And
Yeah. And you know, all the rumors about the hot women and all that, it's true, right? I mean,
is true. They are also
very friendly, very, very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as like, well, actually, I wanted to go back. So you have you're getting a driver's license. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering about immigration in general, like how do you get a residency, and is that hard to do? How does all that work?
Yeah. So there's lots of ways to get visa. Well, first of all, you can stay here for 6 months out of the year without any visa, 3 months at a time. If you want to stay 6 months in a row, you just have to leave for a day and then come back. But there are lots of ways to get visas, you know, which can be for a year or 3 years, 5 years, depending on what it's for. I've had friends get visas from dental work, you know, so medical. They get Invisalign, and that works. Or they are studying Spanish. I got mine as an investor visa when I bought my property. Mm-hmm. That's good for 3 years, and I can renew it at the end of 3 years. And there's different levels of investment visas too. If you get the higher one, and you have it for 5 years, you become a resident. So you get a passport and everything, or a citizen. And then the one I have, if I renew it for 10 years and I'm here for 10 years, or I don't even have to be here for 10 years, but if I continue to renew it, I'll get, you know, citizenship in 10 years.
Okay. And how much of an investment do you have to put down?
So there's two levels, and it changes with the fluctuation with the peso and the dollar. But the first one's like $95,000, and the second one I think is like $175,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a property that you live in. It doesn't have to be like an actual investment. Just any property works.
Yeah, it can be any property. You just have to document it appropriately. So you have to get a letter from the central bank that says it's foreign investment going into Colombia.
Okay.
And they sign off on all that. And then once it's – so when you transfer money into Colombia, also you have to register it and declare it so they know where it's coming from and all those types of things.
Right.
But once that's done, it's not a super complicated process.
Yeah, and for Americans, when you go there, I'm sure a lot of different countries, I'm not sure, I just know about Americans because American, you can go there and you get a 3-month visa right off the bat. And then you can extend it to 6 months, and then you're supposed to leave unless you're a resident, right?
Right.
Yeah, and what happened to me is basically I didn't extend it. And so I stayed past 3 months, and a lot of people said, well, I tried to, but it was kind of hard. I wanted to go to first of all, I tried to do it on the online, and the website, it was like worthless. I was like, I couldn't get anything done. So I guess I got to go to the office, and I was trying to find a time to go to the office, and it was coming to the end of my 3 months, and a number of people told me that, oh, it's no big deal. If you're a little bit over, you just pay a fine when you're leaving. And no big deal. And that's kind of how it is in Mexico. I think that they're changing it. Seems like a lot of countries are kind of like cracking down on immigration and stuff nowadays. But so I went there, and I was – and first of all, the guy, like, he said, oh, okay, good. And he was just about to stamp it. Oh, no, he did stamp it. And then he handed it, and then he's like, wait a minute. And he looked again.
Oh, no.
And he was like, oh, no. And then I had to go back to this room and, like – you know, they were asking me, why did you stay over and all this? And I said, you know, I was having trouble and all that. And they actually, like, deported me. And they put deported on my passport and, walked alongside of me. Like, basically, like, escorted me to the plane.
that's bad you know? Luck.
Yeah, they said I couldn't go back for a year. But it's been a year now, so I guess I can go back. So, you know, just for people out there, you know, you got to be...
Yeah, man.
Gotta think about that. Don't overstay. I guess that's not so cool anymore.
It used to be no big deal, at least from what I understand. You know, I had lots of friends that did it, or they just pay at the airport or wherever it was, you know. But I think part of it is also because they've had such a large immigration of Venezuelans.
Yeah.
You know, they had over 1 million people immigrate last year that were recorded. You know, and the population in Colombia is only 50 million people, so that's a really big percentage in a year. And so I think they've cracked down a little bit because of that.
I hear a lot of people with the Venezuelan thing going on. You know, a lot of people are – I've seen online and stuff that, you know, they'll say that, that a lot of the stuff about the problems in Venezuela, it's all made up by the media, and they're just trying to, like, demonize Venezuela and stuff like that. But I remember being in Colombia. I met a lot of these Venezuelans that were telling me how bad it was. I'm sure you've met a lot, right?
Yeah, no, totally. You know, you drive to the airport, and your Uber driver is telling you how their third-generation family business is completely obsolete now. They can't get materials. They can't sell it because no one will buy it. I mean, it's really – sounds really bad over there.
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of people are leaving if they can, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of people from Colombia, you know, when things were bad here 20-plus years ago, went to Venezuela. So it's very interesting to see how they interact with the Venezuelans, because it's like open arms, you know. They taxis roll down their window and hand them money and stuff like that. And it's kind of like... you know, they're just returning the favor, I guess. But it's also bringing in a lot of really talented Venezuelans, too, because, you know, the engineers and architects and, you know, doctors and all kinds of people that were really educated and professional are coming also because they're right. losing opportunities there too. So, yeah, it's really interesting. It's yeah. sad, but
well, the people are pretty similar, so it's not.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's cool. Let's talk about the book. You wrote a what's the name of the book that you, I think you just wrote? You wrote a chapter in a book that they just released.
Yeah, it's called Resilience.
Mm-hmm. What's up with that? You mind telling us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, sure. It's so I was a co-author in it. Mm-hmm. There's a couple dozen other authors. Really cool stories, overcoming challenges, and man, some of them are really, really powerful stories. We donated all the sales to a charity, which is really cool too. Mm-hmm. One of the other authors in there has this really powerful story. He's quadriplegic. And he had broken his neck when he was in his 20s, the large family too, skiing, and he was starting to recover. And like after a year, he leaned over something, passed out, and the ambulance came to take him away and dropped him off the stretcher and broke his neck again.
Oh, so now he's like,
yeah. So now he wrote the book with, you know, this finger. With the little remote.
Wow.
And so lots of really powerful stories. Mine wasn't, I didn't have something so dramatic in my story. Mine was sort of more about living the life I wanted to. When I was in high school, I was really lucky and I got to spend a couple weeks with a family in Spain. And it was just so different than my life in the States. You know, my parents weren't really getting along, and this family was happy, and the community was happy, and the weather was different, the architecture was different, the food was different, just totally different. So when I got home to the States, it was like, man, this is like a really big world, and people live totally different lifestyles everywhere. Like, how is it that I was born in, you know, the place most fitting for me, you know? So I've kind of been exploring that my whole life, really. And yeah, I've gone to like around 60 countries and lived in quite a few of them, visited a lot of them 3, 4, 5 times. So, but mine's about my story and, you know, making changes until I was able to live that life, I guess.
Awesome. Yeah. So that's Resilience. And I'm sure they can find that on Amazon, right? They just type in Resilience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's on Amazon. Mm-hmm.
All right. And also, you have a course on short-term rentals coming out, right? What's going on with that?
Yeah. Yeah, you can find me in REST Methods. It's REST, like real estate short-term. And I have a free book on there about finding the best markets to invest in, what I think are the best markets and why they're the best markets and things to look out for. So you can get that on there, and then I'm starting a little course just to basically show other people how they can invest in short-term rentals, but in properties that make sense, you know, so build wealth. And I'm hoping to have that first part out at the end of next month on there. But they can get the ebook for free now if they go in there and just fill out their email.
All right. Well, cool. So let's wrap it up. Do you have anything else? I think that you're launching a podcast maybe?
Yeah, I was planning on doing one basically short little bite-sized actionable items that people can use to either improve their existing short-term rentals or to help them in their search to find properties. So it'll be, you know, 7 to 12 minute episodes, pretty easy, but you know, stuff that someone can walk away with, and right. help to release the first one also at the end of next month.
All right, cool. Yeah. So definitely look out for that. So yeah, check out the book. You got the course and got a podcast coming up. So great. A lot of really good information on this podcast about starting it. And you know, we talked about Medellin and things like that. So I hope that people can walk away with some actionable advice. So thanks, Tim, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.